Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, the Santa Cruz Sentinel says about my third guest's book, it's called Step Into Nature, Nurturing Imagination and Spirit in Everyday Life, and they call it 230-plus pages of aliveness. We will also be talking today with Tom Butler, who's the Editorial Projects Director of the Foundation for Deep Ecology and the President of the Northeast Wilderness Trust, and he's put together with a group of other people a great new picture book, which we'll talk about coming up around 12:20 today. But first, I'm very pleased to have with us Dr. Angelo Volandes. He's a physician and researcher at Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital. He's also the founder of Advanced Care Planning Decisions, a non-profit organization devoted to encouraging the conversation through the use of videos. And The Conversation is the title of his new book, A Revolutionary Plan for End-of-Life Care. Dr. Angelo Volandes, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, this really is an important conversation. It is one that can be difficult for some people to approach with their family. But I wanted to begin with this, because I read that when asked where and how Americans want to spend the last few months of their lives, 80% say at home. But in reality, only 24% spend it at home. So talk to us about those statistics, if you would.
Absolutely. This is one of the reasons, the impetus for writing the book, is because as a practicing doctor, I knew that when I asked patients where they wanted to die, the overwhelming majority would tell me they wanted to die at home, surrounded by their loved ones, and outside of the healthcare system. And yet I knew that as a practicing physician, most patients are still dying in our nursing homes, in our hospitals, often tethered to machines and in a good deal of pain. So I was trying to figure out what is happening in this crazy healthcare system that so many people are getting care, in quotes, that they wouldn't want at the end of life. And that's what I realized. Most doctors are simply not slowing down, sitting down, and having the conversation with patients. Because we've designed a healthcare system that unless someone says stop, the assumption is do everything. And that's where the conversation comes into play. Here's where you have a discussion with your doctor, you tell them what your values are, and you express your wishes for end-of-life care, so that when you're not able to make decisions for yourself, at least your doctor understands what's important to you.
Right. Now, as a family member, I can tell you I could talk with my mother about anything from sex to world politics. I could talk with her about anything except end of life. She would not discuss it. She just would not discuss it. And, you know, so we did the best we could do. But so you have a way of approaching this with people, and one of the things you say that it's important to do is to warm up the conversation. We don't want to just dive straight into it, but to warm up the conversation with what kinds of things are important to you in your life. And this is a conversation we should all be having, not just with our parents.
Absolutely. These are questions that all of us should be asking ourselves. But you're right. This is a tough conversation. And hey, I had a hard time talking to my own dad about this. But what I tell people is, look, this is not about death. This is about life. This is about living as long as you can for as well as you can. So let's have a conversation about what's important to you. And so my dad, who actually is sick, I started the conversation by saying, hey, Dad, you know, what's a good day for you? What do you enjoy? And he told me, hey, I enjoy having the sun hit my face, and I enjoy playing with my grandkids. And then I asked him, okay, suppose you became sick and you're not able to do those sort of things, what sort of things would you or wouldn't you want out of healthcare? You know, what are your hopes and fears about healthcare, and what's important to you? And that's when we started a more involved discussion of him explaining to me what sort of things he would or wouldn't want from the healthcare system. And unfortunately, many times doctors are having this conversation at the end. In other words, it's 3 a.m, you're in the ER, you have a terminal illness, and it's the first time that a doctor is actually asking you these questions. And I tell people, what a disservice we as doctors do to our patients by not starting these conversations years before you become sick, when you're actually feeling great. That's the time to start this process.
Right. You have shared in the book that many doctors have conversations in the cafeteria about the things they've put patients through because these points weren't made clear. And so share some of those insights with us, because, you know, we tend to think, and I think, you know, we, first of all, are worried about money. We're also worried that they don't suffer and that they're kept, you know, we don't want to lose them. So what kind of things from a doctor's perspective do you discuss in the cafeteria about this?
Absolutely. And in fact, the 7 stories that I talk about in the book are exactly that. Stories that colleagues share with each other behind closed doors. Are talking to other doctors. These are the stories that we share with each other. For instance, I had a surgical colleague who told me, I can't believe I just did that procedure, that surgical procedure, to this woman with advanced Alzheimer's disease. Or I had an ICU colleague recently tell me, I can't believe we put a feeding tube and a tracheostomy in someone with terminal advanced cancer. And I think it represents some of the frustration among doctors where we got into this to do the right thing, but we've designed a system, the healthcare system, that assumes everything should be done unless the patient or a family member says stop. And a lot of us are wondering, are we doing the right thing if we've designed this crazy healthcare system that does everything except actually talk to the patient? It's a frustration among many of my colleagues. And one of the neat or not so surprising things after the publication of the book was I was getting hundreds of emails from people around the country telling me, hey, I had the same patient just like the one you described in the book.
Right.
And I wondered, did I do the right thing?
Right. Well, you talk in the book about the difference between palliative care and hospice care. I wonder if you'd share a sentence on that.
Absolutely. So let's be clear. Palliative care is different from hospice care. Hospice care are services provided, usually Medicare or a private insurance, for people who have a 6-month prognosis. So people who are at the end of life and need additional services. But palliative care is very different. Palliative care is an extra layer of support for these experts who are in our hospitals and our healthcare system, who are trained to make sure that you get that your wishes are communicated, that the services are coordinated. They're like your coach to navigate this healthcare system. But the neat thing about palliative care is that you could have these services whether you're at the end of life or if you have an illness that might even be cured. So it's for anybody. I like to say if we really had palliative care providers in every single hospital, every patient walking in with a complex illness would want one of these experts who know how to coordinate care. It's the best thing out there, and yet not enough palliative care doctors and nurses and social workers are in the healthcare system today.
Right, and I just want to bring this up because talking of palliative care, in Britain they have the Liverpool Care Path Plan. Do we have something similar to that here?
You know, we don't. And there's a lot of hesitation in the community in this country because there were some failings of the Liverpool pathway.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Actually, in Seattle, you're very fortunate because you have some of the best palliative care doctors in the world. The problem is that we, as a U.S. healthcare system, fail to give the resources needed for palliative care to truly be where it could be. There's 40% of hospitals in America don't even have a palliative care service. Most of the palliative care doctors, nurses, and social workers and therapists are overworked. You know, we're willing to pay $25,000 for a chemotherapy agent for a patient with advanced cancer that might give them an extra week of life, but we're not willing to pay $25,000 to pay for a doctor, a nurse, or a social worker to provide palliative care services. You know, there's a perverse financial incentive right. in our healthcare system, which really doesn't help our palliative care right. colleagues to do their job.
Right. Many people think they're covered because they have a living will and they've spelled things out in the living will. You say in the book that's not enough.
Oh, absolutely. I tell my patients this all the time. Look, living wills are really tough to enact in practice. Just to be clear, a living will is a form that you fill out saying, if I'm in this state, you know, let's say advanced dementia, I would or I wouldn't want, and you fill out this sort of Chinese menu of intervention. That's not very helpful. And I'll tell you why, because a lot of times as a doctor, you're like, well, you know, what did they mean by this? Did they really understand what they were assigning? So I encourage people, although they're going to fill out a living will, go ahead and actually fill out something else called a proxy or a surrogate. But don't just appoint someone name that's going to make actually conversation with them. And one thing I talk about in the book is, you know, go ahead and have this conversation, but use your iPhone or iPad or a tablet and record yourself. Make a short video and tell us what's important to you and what are the things you do or you don't want in terms of medical care, and email that to your doctor, your family, and someday we'll be able to upload those videos into the electronic health record so that if I'm that doc at 3 in the morning in the ER, I could actually look at your record and say, oh my gosh, this person left me a video telling me what's important to them. It would help me tremendously to see your face, your voice, and actually understand whether or not you understood what your wishes were and making those decisions.
And talking of video, that's a good segue because you've actually created your videos to talk to as educational tools. And so when I first read that, I thought, you know, the thing that I would be concerned about is who paid for these. Did the insurance company pay for these? You know, because we're going to get a slightly different slant if an insurance company paid for it than if somebody else. But I did read in your material that you tried to take a very unbiased, true documentarian approach to this, where you try to balance both sides. So talk to us about that, if you would.
Absolutely. So to be clear, we accept no funding from anyone because we're a nonprofit foundation. We, you know, our mission is to empower patients and families. So what we do is we actually gather an expert panel of patients, families, and providers. In other words, doctors and nurses, people who are national experts in this. And what we do is we work with them to understand what are the needs in the community, what do patients tell us they want, and then we work from what patients tell us, we work a script, and then we go and film real patients, real providers, actually doing these procedures, but also talking about these issues, and then over the course of about a year or two, we finalize the video. And again, our goal is to really flip the power dynamic in the healthcare system today, because today, doctors have all the power. If they're not going to talk to you about end of life, you're likely not going to talk about end of life. But what if you had a short video that actually explained to you what your options are? And so we're hoping that our videos flip the power dynamic. We're trying to create a Khan Academy for Medicine, and our first video, which is with the book, it can be found on YouTube. It's at theconversationbook.org, and we really hope that people use the video to empower themselves to get the care that they want.
Mm. Well, Angelo, I read the article in The Atlantic, and the reporter there said that when I heard about Dr. Valander's work, I suspected he would be different from other doctors. I was not disappointed. He refuses to let me call him, for example, Dr. Valander's. Talk to us a little bit about your general approach when you're working with people.
You know, I think all physicians sometimes forget that the person in front of them is someone's mom, dad, granddad, or someone's wife or husband. And I think it takes a few years where something happens to us personally to understand that. And for me, it was when my dad became very sick, and all of a sudden, I was the son. I wasn't the doctor, but I was the son across the table from another physician talking about what decision my dad would want. And it's the first time that I said to myself, gosh, we do this so poorly in healthcare today. And so that memory has stuck with me for the last few years, so that every time I meet that, you know, Mr. Jones or Mrs. Smith, I always say to myself, you know, that's someone's mom or dad. And so I think if doctors just slow down and say that to themselves, hey, this is someone's loved one, I think we'd all be a lot better, because we would treat people the way we hope people treat our own family and someday ourselves.
Right. And you talk, if we can share this quickly, about three levels of care goals, life prolonging, comfort level, and end of life.
Yeah, let me quickly go over that. And these are the same three categories that are available across the country. And in fact, these were formulated in the Northwest, so it's really nice to explain this on the air. Life prolonging care, the goal is to prolong life. It includes anything available in a modern-day hospital, things like CPR and breathing machines. The goal is to prolong life regardless of the complications or the pain and suffering. At the other end of the extreme is comfort care. Here, the goal is to make sure we focus on quality of life, not quantity of life. And so the focus is really on symptom relief. In between those two extremes is something called limited care, where we try interventions that may work, but that are not overly burdensome. So I think if people think about where they're at in terms of their health and think of potential illnesses that they may have, think about those three categories of care: life prolonging care, limited care, and comfort care, and think about how those categories reflect your values and beliefs in terms of illness and what you want out of the healthcare system.
Well, some great advice in here. And I always think that quality of life has to be determined by the individual, because it's so different for everybody. You give some wonderful advice in here. I wish I'd had this book a few years ago. It's called The Conversation, A Revolutionary Plan for End-of-Life Care. And as I said, this doesn't just apply for the conversation we need to have with our parents. It's a conversation we need to have ourselves, with ourselves and with our loved ones. So I do thank you, Angelo, Dr. Angelo Valandis, for being with us today. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with, and please give out your website too.
Sure. The website is theconversationbook.org. The book's available everywhere, including Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com. We also have it as an ebook and as an audio book. And I really hope that the book sparks people to start making decisions that they're happy with and not medical care that they end up getting in our healthcare system. I think that's my hope and ambition for everyone.
Great. Thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
And my guest, of course, Dr. Angelo Valandis, his book, The Conversation, A Revolutionary Plan for End-of-Life Care. We will be right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
I want to thank my mommy for loving me so much.
For taking me to the doctor when I broke my foot.
For leaving me alone when I wanted to be alone.
And now, as a grown-up, I'm thankful for being able to take care of you, my dear mom. For taking you to your therapies. For understanding that sometimes you simply want to be alone.
Roles change without us noticing. That's why AARP gives you the information to provide even better care for your loved one. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Let's see if I guess that This just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Going against the grain has never been so much fun. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. Well, we are talking right now with Tom Butler. He's the Editorial Projects Director of the Foundation for Deep Ecology and the President of the Northeast Wilderness Trust. He's a conservationist and writer, and his books include Wildlands Philanthropy, Plundering Appalachia, Keeping the Wild, and Energy Overdevelopment and the Delusion of Endless Growth. And this is a huge project. This is a features more than 300 pages of full-spread photography. The book is called Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot. Tom Butler, welcome.
Thank you, Vicki.
So I want to just tell our listeners a little bit about this book, because this was put together by a group of people. You took on the editing of this. How did it come about? How did this project start for you, and what was the goal?
Well, the purpose is pretty simple. It's very straightforward. We wanted to show in an emotionally evocative way, primarily through pictures with very little text, the way that the Earth is being transformed by human numbers and human behavior, the 7.3 billion of us on the planet who are busily trying to exploit as much fossil fuels as we as possibly can in as quick as time, and the way we've organized our economic activities, and what that has done to the planet and to people, with the intention of getting people to talk about overpopulation and overconsumption again. You would think that this would be the issue, because it either drives or amplifies all these other range of critical challenges facing humans and nature, but for the most part, no one talks about it.
Right.
And that was our goal with the book, which I, for short, well, I just call Over, and the associated campaign at populationspeakout.org.
Now, you gave away 4,000 copies of this book because you wanted to get people talking about it. And here's the dilemma I always see with this as a documentary filmmaker myself and a writer myself. You know, are you preaching to the converted? How do you get those people who don't really care to start caring?
Well, one never knows if you're preaching to the converted, but of course, as I think Bill McKibben often makes the quip that if you're preaching to the choir, where do the future choir directors come from? So we immediately, you know, in any social change movement, we talk to people who have some affinity about the topic at hand, and those people emerge as great leaders. The goal here was not simply, though, to talk to people who are in the population field, but to be talking to everyone, including policymakers around the globe. The campaign was designed, and the website is in multiple languages. Copies of the book have been shipped to every continent except Antarctica. There are NGO partners around the world, and the population Global Population Speak Out campaign is going to go through all this year, and will later in the year result in books hopefully being hand delivered to every environment minister of every country on Earth.
Now, were some of these photographs touched up, or are they all
No.
In their raw form?
To our knowledge, there was no manipulation. I guess there's one photo montage in the book of the several hundred images. But there are images that are so dramatic and so striking that when the photo researcher who worked in this little editorial team presented them to us, we thought, that's not real. Mm-hmm. That's, when you see an image of a surfer off the coast of Indonesia...
Well, that's the one I'm thinking
exactly
of.
Exactly, being literally catching a wave with all this trash swirling around in the waters. I said to him, that's not real. Go back, double-check that. And he did so, and he assured us that that was a genuine image.
Wow.
So there are photos in the book, and people can see those at the website. There are images like that that are extremely dramatic. If one sees, for instance, a picture of the tar sands unconventional oil development in Alberta, and you see how that place is beautiful boreal forest of Canada is being turned into something like mortar out of Lord of the Rings, that's a particularly egregious example of the toxic current energy economy. But we mostly wanted to show images that would be representative of how do people live? How are people affected in this world of 7.3 billion with the population growing so fast? What's it like for someone in Bangladesh on the train platform who needs to get to work, or someone in Beijing walking through an open area in a haze of air pollution? So the images are both dramatic but also everyday type photos showing how nature and people are being affected by this overpopulation challenge.
Right. There's another one that I wondered if that had been manipulated, and that was with the Ed Begley Jr. quote on there. And I just pulled my thing, bookmark out, and I've lost the page now. But he said something like, why when we destroy something man-made do we call it vandalism, and when we destroy nature we call it progress?
Exactly. Well, those brief quotes, and there is some text. The heart of the book is this images, but there's also a beautiful foreword by Musimbi Kanyoro, the current president of the Global Fund for Women, and an introduction by William Ryerson, the head of Population Media Center, a group that is doing absolutely brilliant work running primarily radio novellas, long-running radio soap operas that affect social norms and behavior change in more than 50 countries in the developing world. And also, finally, a beautiful afterword by the writer and thinker Eileen Crist, who challenges us to think about a vision of a planet of life and how the balance between the places we leave aside for nature that can support a diversity of life and a flourishing, and the places that we use for people can support a flourishing human civilization, what that reality needs to be. And in part, now I'm circling back to your Ed Begley quote, it means the idea that the Earth, we have to rethink this idea that the Earth is merely a collection of resources for human use and profit,
right,
as opposed to a community of life to which we belong.
Some of the photos, I mean, are really quite shocking, and I've seen a lot of this stuff. I had this out on my coffee table for a couple of weeks. I'm like wondering if anybody's going to go through and look at all the pages. I think I'm the only one who did go through and look at all the pages, but it's hard for people to take in, but I do think it's important. One of the things that, you know, is shocking and upsetting to me, when you saw the two pages full of, are they bear paws?
I think there is a bear paw shot. There's also a gorilla paws. Gorilla feet, too. But well, there are bear paws.
I couldn't tell because there's claws on this one, but there's also pads, so I couldn't tell. Yeah, and when you see it laid out like that, and then you see another double page spread with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of shark fins in there, it's just really shocking.
Well, it is disturbing, and that was part of the reason why we used images, primarily to tell this story. It is shocking to think about. This conversation is not happening. We talk all the time about the extinction crisis, biodiversity loss, or the need for green energy and climate chaos. We talk about poverty, rising social inequity. All these kinds of challenges that are facing people and nature, for the most part, we're talking about the symptoms. But the driver the underlying driver or amplifier, that is the extremely rapid human population growth and the even larger growth of consumption of the Earth's resources, for the most part, is simply undiscussed. It's rather bizarre, too, if you think about it. If in your neighborhood a house was bursting into flames and burning to the ground every night, and this happened over and over, and the response of your neighbors in the community was to say, well, obviously we need more fire trucks and a bigger budget for the fire department, and other people said, no, what we need are better building regulations, and we need to change all the wood frame construction to masonry. That'll solve the problem. But if no one was saying, what's causing the fire? Is there an arsonist on the loose or a gas leak? We would think that's an absurd level of public discourse. But yet, that, in effect, is the way we treat this overpopulation, overconsumption, overshoot challenge. We don't talk about the root drivers of all these other issues that we're facing.
Right. And I just read that another state has joined Florida in banning the discussion of global climate change now. They're not allowed to discuss that in certain factors. I mean, I think it's very good that we have stuff like this out there. How do you plan to, you know, you get this into the hands of 4,000 people, and then what do you hope happens from there?
Well, 4,000 people receiving the book, or the other thousands who may buy it, and we're actually going to probably do another print run. That's all well and good. We really hope that people will look at the book. But the campaign itself, the larger media campaign at populationspeakout.org is going to be, we hope, will reach many, many poor people. I know just a single website in the last 2 weeks that you ran a slideshow excerpt has gotten more than 2.5 million page views. So there's a much, much larger social media campaign to the effort. But again, the question isn't just the number of eyeballs, or it's the goal is to get people talking about this issue, because the population challenge is something we can actually do something about. It's politically achievable, and it's affordable. And we know what works. If you elevate the status of women, you educate girls, and you make family planning tools and information universally available, well, birth rates come down, and they do that cross-culturally in many different kinds of countries.
It is
the question is just having the political will to make that happen across countries and as rapidly as possible, and be discussing this question with the level of urgency it demands.
Right. And it is about education. So, you know, we can't, as you point out in the book, go into countries and tell them what they can and can't do about birth control. But, you know, there are people in countries who don't have access to birth control or aren't fully educated on birth control that would use it if we educated them properly. How can we get actively involved? I know you go to the website, you've got up there shareable postcards, videos, activist sign-ups. How do we make a dent in that education ourselves?
Well, I would hope that everyone would do that using the tools you just mentioned, but also to be thinking about local efforts that they can do. There's a sort of a crowdsourced media campaign effort that people can enroll at the website, to be thinking creatively about ways of getting this topic back as a part of our public discourse. You know, because the challenge is not just in the developing world. Most of the high fertility countries are in the developing world, and the crises there are ones of human poverty and lack of education for and lack of empowerment and lack of gender equity, particularly for girls. The problem in the overdeveloped world, of course, is that we're the ones breaking the climate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not those people on the platform in Bangladesh that have destroyed the chemical composition of the atmosphere. It's us. And so the overpopulation and overconsumption challenge can begin with everybody where you are, both acting in their own lives, but also speaking out and getting this topic again as one of conversation, because it truly has been the great taboo. What group do you know, what mainstream environmental group in the United States has an active and vibrant population program?
Right.
You can't name one. A generation ago, when the first Earth Day event happened, everyone who considered themselves part of the then-budding environmental movement was extremely concerned about overpopulation. And that linkage has dissipated over the decades, and it's time for anyone who considers themselves concerned about the fate of the Earth to again be thinking about the human population trajectory.
Well, I think it's a very powerful book, and seeing some of the images in here makes you pause and think, you know, you may care about it, but when you see this book, you're like, well, okay, caring is one thing. What can I do about it? So, Tom Butler, I think you're a great spokesman for this. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
And would you please give out your website one more time?
Yes, the Global Population Speak Out campaign and information about the book can be found at populationspeakout.org.
Thank you so much. My guest, Tom Butler, he's the editorial projects director. He helped put this book together. Over development, over population, over shoot, it's called. And please do stay with us. We will be right back.
Looking for unconditional love? An exercise buddy or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
OMG! Grammar abuses, no, LOL. Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Designing Health, makers of Missing Link, we cover the world of animals. This week, April 19th, it's a best Sunday with Dr. Nels Rasmussen. We'll have open phone lines throughout the show. He can help with emotional, behavioral, or physical problems, and he can test for allergies, drug, or supplement compatibility and dosages for you or your animal friends. Call in early for a free remote session. Martha Norwalk's Animal World. Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Join us live every Monday at noon on Alternative Talk 1150 or stream live from conversationslive.net.
You're listening to Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. The Santa Cruz Sentinel calls my next guest's book 230-plus pages of pure aliveness. Patrice Vecchione is my guest. Her new book is called Step Into Nature, Nurturing Imagination and Spirit in Everyday Life. Patrice is also the author of Writing and the Spiritual Life, two poetry books, and the editor of many highly acclaimed anthologies. She also puts on creative working and collage workshops. And she's a poet, artist, author, and we're pleased to have you here. Patrice Vecchione, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I told you I had a super busy week last week, but I did step into nature to read your book, Step Into Nature. And I very much appreciated it because I love nature. And so we just talked about it in one respect. We're going to talk about it in a whole other respect right now. You said that your love of nature and ultimately this book began when you became infatuated with woods. You say that nature began working on you. Tell us about that.
I didn't go out. I wasn't a nature girl. That wasn't my inclination. I went into the woods because I could no longer ride a bicycle because of a neck injury. So I went there for exercise, and I was completely taken aback by how I transformed. I began to breathe more easily and more deeply. I began to notice my environment, both in the woods and everywhere else. My empathy got larger. I'm not always certain that's a great thing, but it got larger, and I began to care for parts of the world I had never cared for before in a much more intimate way. My senses became enlivened, and I wanted to make art. I wanted to have an imaginative conversation with the natural world.
Well, there was a Japanese haiku master that you mentioned in the book. You say that when you began walking in the forest, it never occurred to you to make the universe your companion, as he suggests. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, that's the poet Basho, and in his very simple three-line, on the outside, very simple three-line poem, he considers nature his companion. And I always thought there was a distinction between the natural world and the human world, though, of course, we are nature. I just never had a personal awareness of that. I encountered a rat out in the woods one day, and frankly, I don't like rats, but this rat was shivering in the sun. It was a hot day, and there this little rat was sitting shivering. And I got down on my hands and knees and had a conversation with her. She had been injured.
Aww.
And I thought, Lord, help me. What am I doing? But yes, that's the idea, because one being suffering is the same as any being suffering, which is, of course, the Buddhist teaching. I just didn't know it up front and personal.
Well, that's a good example, I think. You said that this book, amongst other things, is designed to strengthen the trust in spirit. And we have to have that interconnectedness, I think, to have a strong spirit. So what does that mean to you, strengthen your spirit?
To recognize that there is less division between the human-made world and the nature world. To find subtlety in relationship that we noticed. I noticed a blue flower that I was stopped mid-step looking at this flower. In the past, I would have thought, oh, there's a flower. Yes, it's very nice. Let's keep walking. Let's get our exercise. But I noticed these little things, from bees buzzing in a hive to a blue flower to a rat who was dying. And I felt my spirit become larger. It felt fused to the natural world. I believe that if we are to care for the earth, we need to have personal relationships. Otherwise, we think of the earth in an abstract way. One does not have personal relationship with abstraction. One has personal relationship with that which we care for, that which lifts our spirit, and the earth has lifted mine.
The poet Wallace Stevens says, this is a quote from your book, "Perhaps the truth depends on a walk around the lake." And I cannot tell you how many times I've gone a walk around the lake before acting on something.
Right.
Sometimes we see it totally differently afterward.
Exactly. It's a little more, a little longer than the idea of counting to 10 before making a comment, you know. But it's the same idea, but there's an additional piece to it, which is that I discovered when my feet are in motion, when I'm walking, I think differently than when I am in my house or in my car or sitting at a restaurant or sitting still anywhere, that the process of moving my body through space and getting my heart pumping and getting breath and listening to the surroundings changes the way my mind works. Many famous writers from history, in addition to Wallace Stevens, like Dickens, he was known for taking walks around London late at night. Darwin, at the base of his property, had built a walking area, and he would walk back and forth on this lane because he knew that thoughts came more freely when his feet were moving.
Yes, it's something about that rhythm, I think, and just being in the fresh air as well.
Exactly.
So you have a segment here called Infectious Influence, How Nature Changes Us, and you call that Infectious Influence. Talk a little bit about what's been the biggest. You've talked about how it's made you more empathetic, your compassion has grown. How has this influenced you as an artist? How's it changed you as an artist?
My subject matter has changed significantly. I do collage work, and then I'm a poet, and then a nonfiction writer. In the past, it would not have occurred to me to have nature as the basis for a paragraph, let alone the basis for a book and many poems. So that really shifted, just the subject, and then the sense of slowing things down. There's an ease in nature, not always, of course, but often just watching a leaf fall from a tree. It's a slow, methodical process. And, oh, if I slow myself down and notice at a level that is more evenly paced and more calm, then the actual act of making art shifts. So there's more detail in my work. There's more nuance. My visual work, I've been doing a lot of collage work using images, physical, like flower petals. My father grew zinnias, and in part he grew them for me so he could dry them and give me the petals of the flowers.
Mm.
And then I take those dry petals and make collage from them. I might turn them into the roof of a house or any number of other things. So the actual visual art has changed. I've got one piece where I stuff pine needles in an open box, another piece where lichen is crammed into a box. When we can take nature out of its typical context, then we see it more clearly, I think.
Right. I think there are a lot of lessons in nature. My parents always taught us that, and I was thinking of that just yesterday. I walked before I read your book, but I was on the beach and a new tree had come down. It was an old tree, but it was newly fallen. And it had been hanging on that cliff for the longest time. And suddenly it's this week it was down on the beach, but its roots were still hanging on into that cliff. And I thought, you know, there's a lesson in tenacity for all of us, you know.
Isn't there? And we need that lesson. We need to be tenacious people to live our lives wholly.
Mm. I like this quote in the book, Henry David Thoreau, "Not until we are lost do we begin to find ourselves." And you have a chapter called This Way, Peggy, Losing and Finding Our Way. And I actually wrote an essay years and years and years and years ago. It was published in an anthology called Lost and Found. And I was feeling lost, and I was not being able to make this very important decision that I was making about moving and career change and et cetera. There was a lot involved. And one beach ride on a horse, and I just knew exactly what I needed to do. So talk to us about this, not until we're lost do we begin to find ourselves, and how you see that.
So I see it in two ways. I see it both in the way you're referring to, which is our lives being lost in our lives, and it lost emotionally unsure of what direction to take. And then there's also the physical act of being lost in the woods. I get lost in the woods, and I don't much like the experience of being lost there or when I'm lost in my own life. We tend to recoil from that because it's the uncertainty in that experience. And so now when I get lost in the woods, I try to slow myself down and calm myself and say, okay, you're only lost. Somehow you got here. You can turn around and get back. Now, of course, there are places in nature where that is not so easily done, where people are truly deeply lost and they need a rescue team to find them. But I don't go that far astray. So I stay in that experience of being lost, rather than in the past, both spiritually and emotionally, I would tend to flee that place. I don't want to feel this. Let me out of here. So having been lost in the woods many times and having been found myself back where I wanted to be, I am able to employ that method when I feel lost in my life.
Mm. There's a quote in here by Rumi, there's a strange frenzy in my head of birds flying. And you talk about inspiration and intuition. You talk about how walking in nature has inspired you. You talked about how it's improved your intuition or heightened your level of intuition. Tell us how.
Well, because when you're when you're in the woods or in any natural place, there are less things competing for our attention. When I'm driving a car, I have to be aware of the other cars on the road and the traffic signs and is there a pedestrian and am I going to be on time? When I'm out in the woods, you know, no bank teller tells me I've overdrafted my account. You know, I'm not late to an appointment.
Right.
So because the pace of life is, I'm less distracted, there are fewer distractions, then I become more aware of my deeper way of knowing the world, which is through spirit and through intuition. And I have come to discover that intuition and inspiration are very much linked. When we are intuitive, we become aware at a deeper level. When we feel inspiration as artists, we feel that tingle, we get an idea, we don't know where it's come from, we have something to say or a color we want to put on the canvas, that's because we're actually listening to our intuitive mind.
And you say that nature simultaneously draws you inward and outward. We only have like 1 minute here, Patrice, but I wonder if you could just elaborate on that.
Well, yeah, you can't stay in if you're out walking. You've got to pay attention to where you're putting your feet and, you know, is it going to rain? But then you can retreat inside for a little while and observe how you're being affected by the flickers up in those trees and the owls farther away. And then so you go out and you listen and then you take what you hear outside and you bring it inside and it affects who you are internally.
Right. Well, I love this book. It's called Step Into Nature, Nurturing Imagination and Spirit in Everyday Life. My guest, Patrice Lecchioni, and you can see her tomorrow if you're in the Seattle area. She's coming up to Elliott Bay Books tomorrow, Tuesday, April 14th, 7 p.m., right? 7 p.m.,
yes. 7 p.m.
So, and you're doing a book signing and reading there.
Yes.
All right. So, and can you please give listeners your website, too?
It's Patrice Vecchioni.com, PatriceVecchioni.com.
Super. Thank you so much for being with us, Patrice. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And again, the book is called Step Into Nature, Nurturing Imagination and Spirit in Everyday Life. Patrice Vecchioni, my guest, and you can see her at Elliott Bay Books tomorrow night at 7 p.m. Well, if you have questions or feedback on any of today's guests or comments on the show, you can reach me at info@conversationslive.net, or you can call 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. You can also find me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair and on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Until next week. Live well, live strong. If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net.
Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
OMG! Grammar abuses, no, LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.